Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by you. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member today.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Today, we're going to be talking all about plastics, how many types there are, the realities of recycling it, what action is being taken to reduce single-use plastic, and what its connection to climate change is. Joining me on the line to discuss is Laura Parker. Laura is a staff writer at National Geographic who specializes in covering climate change and marine environments, and who has written extensively about the plastic crisis. Laura, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me on a Sunday evening during the holidays. I know it's a little bit of a not the best time, but I really appreciate you being here today.
Well, I have nothing better to do than to talk with you.
Very wonderful. So today we're going to delve into the wonderful world of plastics, and you have obviously written extensively on this. So I just want to start by asking how you got interested in this field in particular. What drew you to want to write about the plastic industry?
Oh, that's an unusual story. I'm a child of the Pacific Northwest. Grew up on the Pacific Northwest beaches. I've lived in the Boston area. I've lived in Miami, so I've spent a lot of time on the coasts. But I had never heard of the plastic problem until after I started at National Geographic in 2014. And within the first few days of me going there, the Malaysian plane went missing, and I was assigned to cover the ocean search. It's very difficult to lose a Boeing 777 jumbo jet, and so they thought the ocean search would be interesting, and we did do a few pieces on it. But as the search continued, because we all thought the plane would be found, the debris would be found fairly quickly, but the search continued into the second, and obviously now it still hasn't been found. But in the second week, there were multiple satellite images that captured large collections of floating debris on the surface. And in each instance, the search ships rushed to the scene, expecting to find or hoping to find the debris path from the airplane, and in each instance, it was plastic trash. And after the third or fourth time this happened, and all these stories unfolded in exactly the same way, I went back into the office and I said, I think we're going to stop with the search, and I'm going to do something on this trash. And that was the first story I wrote. We had a phenomenal response to it, and I've been covering plastic ever since.
Wow, that's fascinating. So just to start, there are a lot of statistics out there about the extent to which, plastic is a problem and the negative impacts. I think a lot of them personally are really hard to kind of wrap my head around because they're just, the numbers are so large. I don't even, there's no like kind of context for me other than to know that it's just terrible, right? But I'm wondering, it's just really, really bad. I'm wondering though, if you have maybe like one or two statistics that you think, and it personally have been very impactful to you that you want people to know about.
I think the one that came out in the Jenna Jambeck study from 2015, and Jenna is an engineering professor at the University of Georgia, and she and her colleagues produced the first analysis of how much plastic is slipping in and leaking into the oceans every year, which really helped this subject just explode in 2015. In terms of attention to the world, by the world, and really putting a spotlight on it. And her findings were that it is about 9 million tons leak into the ocean from coastal nations every single year, or the equivalent of one dump truck load every minute. And both of those numbers are very hard to get your mind around.
Mm-hmm.
Another number that's out there is in terms of microplastics, which is plastic trash that has been worked on by UV rays from the sun and by wave action and wind, and broken into tiny, small they're called microplastics, tiny pieces about the size of a grain of rice or smaller. There are 5.2 trillion of those pieces in the ocean, and that was a study that also was published in the same year as Jenna's study, which is an even more incomprehensible number.
Right.
And so those are the big numbers. A lot of the numbers involving plastic and plastic waste and plastic production are big numbers, and pretty soon they overwhelm your mind, I think, and it makes it difficult for ordinary folks who aren't tracking with this to kind of keep up with things. I think that's partly why the straw campaign in the last year or two became very popular and caught on in ways that people didn't expect, because that was a way into the topic that was understandable and easy to absorb, and helped lead the way into the more complicated parts of it.
Right. And so, are there discrepancies in the numbers? Or I imagine it's fairly hard to track, not just plastic straws, but you know, like I would say, all packaging.
The numbers are fast moving because the industry is fast moving. Lots of changes are occurring. A lot of numbers are based on modeling, and then scientists go back and get some hard data. It's very expensive to go out and do research and get hard data, because if you're measuring plastic in the ocean in any way, that usually involves a ship, and that is another complicating factor that makes it tough to get those numbers. And then industry numbers, the difficulty there is sorting out numbers from different countries, which may be measuring things slightly differently, and then the fact that that this is a topic that's just moving with the speed of light.
Right. You said 2015 was when this issue really started to pick up. I thought it was popular for longer. I don't know why I thought that.
It goes back. Yes, as I learned naively when I got onto this in 2014, was I had come into the middle of a play. This dates back to the 1980s. NOAA, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which is the main science agency in the United States, had a conference in the 1980s in Honolulu. This was hardly a secret. It just hadn't gotten a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of things happened in that 2014 and 2015 period, which were the search, the ocean search, which was carried on cable television at the beginning all day long. I remember talking to a scientist about it, and says, if this is when I myself discovered that I was a latecomer to the subject, I said, so what's changed? And she said, well, this is the first time the whole world has been paying attention to this. The second thing is Jenna's study, as I mentioned a minute ago, in 2015 really also helped push this to the forefront, because now there were some numbers that were there that people could look
go
at
from.
Industry and governments, scientists, and then there's just been an acceleration of work. There are studies that are published regularly now. You can't even keep up with them. And it's 2 or 3 years ago, 5 years ago, just a handful of studies might be produced in a year.
Wow.
And it's and the new developments are fairly new. I think the development of microplastics, I'm going to get the date wrong, but I think it the first study was written, I think it was in 2004, on microplastics by a scientist at Plymouth University in the UK. His name is Richard Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not, you know, that's not that long ago.
The discovery that this is actually a thing.
That microplastics are a problem.
Right. So I realize I want to kind of like take a step back and for like really lay out the basics and some of the terminology, because, you know, we talk about plastics, but I don't think that there's a deep understanding of what plastics really are. So, I mean, I think of plastics as just being one thing. Are there multiple types of plastics?
The standard defining points for plastics are the numbers that you'll see inside the little triangle on the chart that comes on the bottom of the bottle, or the chart that is sent to you by your local city that explains the recycling program. And there are seven; those are numbered 1 through 7, and 7 different types of plastics: PET, which is polyethylene tetrahydrolate. I always mispronounce it.
Yeah, I don't know.
is basically water bottles or drink bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's high density polyethylene, HDPE, which would be used to your laundry detergent will come in that, or shampoo bottles. It's stronger, denser, thicker than PET. There's PVC, which is used, you'll see that a lot in building constructions. Low-density polyethylene will be your plastic bags, shopping bags, things like that. Polystyrene will be the white foam coffee cups that keep drinks hot or cold, and the clamshell packaging that contains takeout food. And so all of these are the basic types when people are talking about plastics.
And styrofoam's a plastic? I feel like that's a really stupid question. But
yes, it yes. is.
Okay. A stupid question? No, I'm just kidding.
It's in the plastics family, yes.
Okay, that is something that I was kind of a little bit confused about. Okay, so those are the 7 types of programs or plastics. It's funny you said something about like city recycling, you know, city recycling information that you would receive. And I feel like there isn't a whole lot of information out there about recycling, but we'll talk about recycling in a minute. But for now, okay, so those are that's a really helpful breakdown on the types of plastics. What about when we hear these words, like single-use plastics versus, I don't know, what are the other kind of categories? Like compostable, recyclable, is all plastic recyclable? I just threw a lot at you, but I would say the difference between single use, let's start with single use versus other types of
single
plastic.
Use is what it
sounds like.
Is what it sounds like. You use it once and dispose of it.
Does that mean it's not recyclable?
No, that means you use it once and dispose of it. So 40% of plastic manufactured today worldwide is used for packaging, and single use plastic most of the time refers to packaging. It's the film that your sandwich is wrapped in. It's the drink bottle. It's the plastic bag. It's the styrofoam. I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to use that term. It's the foam cup. All of that. Those are things that are used once and then
discarded.
Disposed of. Discarded.
Okay. But is that because the type of plastic is only meant to be used once?
Yes.
So what about the other types of plastics? So the second part of my question was, are all plastics recyclable?
More plastics are recyclable than people think, but it gets complicated pretty quickly because recycling regulations vary from city to city and county to county, and plastics that are recyclable in County X may not be recyclable in County Y, depending on how they're collected, how they're sorted, mostly how they're sorted, and what happens to them. Certain plastics need to be sorted so that they don't contaminate the stream as bottles, for instance, or other products are taken back to their elemental parts and remade into new products.
So what about, so when we think about like recycling, I was found out in the past year or so, which is embarrassing, that those plastic bags that I get from the, well, not anymore, but, from our bodega or when I'm going shopping or whatever, that I can't put those into the recycling bin, the typical recycling bin. Is that an example of something that can't be recycled because of different regulations or because of the type of plastic and where?
Plastic shopping bags can be recycled. And the problem with them is in certain recycling operations that are operated after your city or county government has collected everything in your blue bin out on your front step. It gets into a facility, and if it's got plastic bags from the grocery store in it, those bags will tend to get caught in the machinery of that facility and are off. And so cities and counties often will say, no, we don't want to take those. You can take those bags, though, back to the store. Often the grocery store will have a bin out in front of the store that's where you can stuff your bags. Those bags are then picked up by the company that delivers the new shopping bags to the store, and they're taken back. And some of them are recycled. They can be recycled. And then some of them, it depends on the cost of recycling and remanufacturing new bags. And so if that cost exceeds virgin material to make new bags, then those bags sadly may end up in a landfill.
So how do you really know? We have no idea what happens.
I mean, if you want to pursue it by tracing it back, that it's not undiscoverable, but most people don't do that.
I would imagine also most companies don't want to totally, I mean, I'm just, speculating here, but I feel like...
Well, your grocery store may not even know.
That they can accept plastic bags?
No, that what happens to them after leaves their property.
Right, yeah, absolutely. So how did we, when did plastics really even first take hold? Like, in what I've read, I've heard it described as a miracle. When it was first kind of developed, when was that time?
It's still a miracle. Plastics, really, plastic products, plastic consumer products, really took off after World War II. In the years where there was a lot of growth in consumer markets and plastic, there's the now infamous. A story in Life magazine that features the family standing around and all these disposable items are thrown up in the air, and it was celebrating in their headline the throwaway living, which was designed and advertised as bringing a convenience to people, particularly the American housewife. Instead of having to do dishes every night, these dishes could just be thrown away. And that really started in the 1950s. I think that magazine was published in 1955, and then the industry just went from there. But it isn't all the throwaway culture, and we can go back to your mention of plastic was advertised as being a miracle product. It was. Just go into a hospital today, if you're visiting anyone who have a relative in the hospital, and modern medicine would not be what it is today without plastic. Tubes, IV bags, every type of equipment that is helped make the advances of medicine can be found in hospitals. your car is lighter now because it's parts of it are made out of plastic. We never would have made it into space without plastic. So I could go on and on about that, but I think that makes the point.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think, you know, when we talk about, it's just very interesting to me that something that has so many benefits is also has so many problems associated with it.
Well, it's not plastic that has problems. It's plastic waste that has problems. Plastic products are fine. Plastic waste is the issue. And, of course, many plastic products, just as going back to the 40% that are used for packaging, that's where the focus needs to be. What to do about all of that stuff when it becomes waste, especially when some of it becomes waste within minutes after purchase.
Right. This was, so in my previous role, I worked at a online farmers market and food delivery service, grocery delivery service, and the number one question that we would get from consumers before we switched to compostable bags was, you know, like the request was, please stop using plastic bags. And it was always a real struggle because I think that there, you know, it's hard to kind of find a replacement, especially in something like food service where there are food safety concerns. And it's just kind of like a fine line because I don't know what the, you know, it's hard to find an alternative. I think that is kind of like up to snuff in terms of being able to have the same benefits that plastic does.
That is one of the challenges that is sort of central to the issue here is if we get rid of product X, what's going to replace it and what makes sense? And then you get into all kinds of questions. Is paper, which is wrapping something in paper, you know, someone will say, well, does that have a carbon footprint as well, and should we really be doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And then there are some things, as you say, certain food products that are just the shelf life of them is extended. They will last longer if they're mm-hmm. wrapped in plastic. And so that's an issue that's being worked on multiple levels by scientists and researchers in the industry.
It is sort of funny, and not to talk about too much about my work, but I went from that the online farmers market to I now work in food waste. And when I was working at the farmers market, we switched from plastic to compostable bags, which was amazing. And the only downside, I would say, for me personally, before I had to kind of like change some of my behaviors, was that I started to get products that would turn in like immediately, right? Like the next day they'd start to brown because they were in compostable bags. So they just, it would start to break down, and then that became like a food waste problem. So I just realized I sort of mirrored that in my career choices as now I work in food waste. But that to me seemed like just a kind of a good example of how all of these issues are infinitely complicated, and there are always unintended consequences of any action, I would say, that you, when you try to do the right thing. But okay, so we are going to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about what is happening to address the waste problem and what it will take to really get some impactful action moving on this issue. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by you. Heritage Radio Network makes your favorite food podcasts. And now we need you to lend your voice to our community and show your support of food radio. Become a member today. HRN releases 35 weekly shows each week and is a globally respected voice in food media. But believe it or not, we're still a very small grassroots organization. HRN is powered by a small but mighty staff of 4 people and HRN's incredible hosts who volunteer their time to bring you the best food podcasts out there. Our hosts are experts in their field, whether it's food writing, mixology, culinary history, craft beer, LGBTQ issues, and so much more. And they're committed to making sure that the stories that matter to you keep coming each week. We believe that a thoughtful, committed group can change the world. So join us. Add your voice and support HRN by making a donation of any amount. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
And we're back with Laura Parker from National Geographic. Laura, okay, so before the break, I said that we were going to talk a little bit more about solutions to this issue. But and I just actually want to go back to, you said something about the plastic straws, right, at the beginning, which I think is, you're 100% right. It's become like the focal point, I think, of many environmental campaigns over the past couple of years. Is this because it was just... it was like an example of what people could do, or was there, like you said, or was there also some kind of other reason behind why plastic straws took hold in terms of like it wasn't very recycled very often or some other substantive reason?
There's a very famous turtle in Costa Rica who's on YouTube that had a straw up its nose, one of its nostrils.
Yeah.
And that, I haven't looked at it recently, but last time I looked at it, that video had been viewed multiple million times. And the crew that rescued the tortoise finally pulled the straw out of the nostril of the turtle, and the turtle was apparently fine. It was released and was okay. But that was a long 6 or 7 minute painful extraction. And I think that had a lot to do with helping, that kind of came along at the right moment as the whole issue of plastic and plastic waste, and do we have too many things made out of plastic, and are there certain things that we can discard? And a straw, unless you have a medical condition, and there are those who do, and that caveat always has to be raised.
Mm-hmm.
But if you drink normally, it is not necessary to have a straw in order to consume a glass of water or a glass of soda pop. And I think that with the very emotional footage of the turtle and the combination of those things kind of came along at the right time and the right moment and blew up into an issue in ways that I think took a lot of people by surprise. If we got rid of every straw on the planet, it would be an infinitesimally small solution to a gargantuan waste problem, and really wouldn't make that much difference. And so there were those who were poo-pooing straw. I mean, they were like, don't tell me about another straw campaign.
Right.
But I think the straw campaigns served a purpose because it gave the ordinary consumer who is not out there reading statistics about plastic production and plastic products that are out and inventions and all of the variables that are out there, it gave that person a way into a complicated subject that was easy to understand, and then they were able to build on that. So if we do straws, then what do we do next? And I think that kind of helped. You'll see a lot of activism that was centered around that.
Yeah. Okay. So what are the two besides emotional YouTube videos, which work, and that's a good thing that was put out there. What are the two types, or you know, a couple types of typical kind of interventions that we've seen where aimed at curbing plastic use or production? By interventions, I mean like, you know, like regulatory, legislative, things along those lines.
Right. Government has very limited options in what they can do. They can ban certain products, or they can put a tax on them. They can also regulate them in terms of, for instance, with bags, put a regulation on how the thickness of a bag and how many microns thick it is, which some places have done. And so we're seeing that play out not only in the United States and around the world. The EU, which is leading the way on the issue of plastic waste, also has another tool in their toolbox, which is known as the extended producer responsibility, which requires plastic product sellers and producers to pay what amounts to a tax, a certain percentage. I won't go through the complications of the formulas to help localities clean up the waste and collect the waste. And in other words, they're requiring the producers of plastic to take responsibility at some level for disposal of the of their products after they become waste. We don't have that in the United States. I could be incorrect on this, but I'm pretty sure the EU is the only place that's got that in, element in place right now. What we are seeing elsewhere are bans. Plastic bags have been banned in multiple countries, and we're also seeing bag fees being added. If you want a plastic bag, you have to pay a 5 cent. Cents or 10 cents or something like that. That's in the UK, that's in Washington, D.C. It's the fee is in multiple place cities. And I think the bag bans are in, what is my number, something like 50 or 60 countries.
When we say bans, just to clarify, is that on the production of bags or is that on... using them in a retail environment? Where does the ban, who does the ban affect, like, first?
Let's talk about bag bans, because, and producers of bags hate these bag bans because they're different everywhere. And so it makes it very difficult to have any kind of uniformity in manufacturing something for sort of a certain region if you're dealing with this sort of patchwork quilt of regulations that's not consistent. I think the UN has counted 127 countries that have either banned or taxed bags as of, I think that number is as of a couple of years ago. Africa is leading the way with 34 or something countries. India is banned. Individual states in India have banned bags. And most of these bans are targeting the manufacture of. They are not trying to go after the consumer who's coming home with a shopping bag full of groceries and ending up, you know, getting arrested or getting cited, ticketed. Their target is people who manufacture the bags. You have to stop, or in some cases, if they still allow the manufacture of plastic bags, but with thicker microns, which would make it easier to recycle, or even the cloth bags that are quote unquote cloth contain an element of plastic. But the thinking on that is that they are reusable, they'll be reused many, many times, and they are not so flimsy that they're going to end up in the ocean being eaten by a turtle or something.
I want to step back, and I apologize if I'm all over the place here.
That's okay.
But I wanted to ask you about, like, the life cycle of a plastic product. Maybe the plastic bag or whatever, you know, whatever one you would like to speak to, but I'm wondering if you can kind of take us through what the life cycle would be, like, from, like, kind of where does it start and where does it end up and why?
Well, it's manufactured. They're 99% of plastic products are made out of oil-based. They're based in oil, so as they go through the petroleum refining process, which I'll spare you the details, and they turn up in as plastic bags are delivered to the store. The store sells it to you. You take it home, and let's just say that you throw it away, put it in your trash.
Which is probably more true than not, right? Did I ask you earlier about recycling rates?
Or yeah.
how little it is? Okay, so
very... Yeah, so you put it in your trash, so it's life cycle, depending on where you want to draw the lines, or it could be just a matter of minutes or an hour. If it's a sandwich that you purchased at lunch, went out for lunch and bought a sandwich and went back to work, it's really is a matter of minutes. And then that ends up in the trash, and then it ultimately ends up in a municipal landfill somewhere.
How does it make its way to the ocean? You know, how do those kind of, is that just improper?
A lot of the estimates on the amount of plastic that is leaking into the ocean were based on modeling and using data from the World Bank. And there's, I think, a lot of new analysis that's underway that will become available in the coming years, scientists and researchers are actually going to the scene, going to the place and looking for leakage. A great deal of plastic ends up in the ocean because it ends up in a river. It gets in a water system. It gets washed down a storm drain and ends up getting drain empties into a river, and the river flows downstream into, and that's where plastic all over the world ends up in the ocean.
Okay.
And so that's, I think that answers that question.
Yeah. And then this, you know, I've been talking about climate change, obviously, with all of the reports that have come out, like, you know, in the past year, I've been talking about it more and more. What is the, you know, like, how do, and this may seem like a really rudimentary question, but like, how do plastics contribute to climate change? Is it mostly what happens when they're in landfill and the pollution of the ocean?
I'm not sure, other than the fact, when people try to connect plastic to climate change, they're talking about oil production. About 8% of the oil production now is for plastic. That's both for the plastic product and for the production of the plastic product and the power involved in making that product. I haven't heard a lot of people talking about plastic in the ocean is somehow contributing to climate change. I think the warming oceans and ocean acidification and those other climate issues are more relevant to that discussion.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Thank you for that. Okay. So we'll get back to talking about what we were before I took us on this tangent, which is kind of solutions. And you discussed some of the things that are happening primarily that the EU is leading on. What about domestically? Are there certain states that are more progressive? I'm imagining that there are, than others. And where are they?
In the United States, there is no federal legislation to address plastic waste or bans or taxes on bags or any of that, and there is not likely to be anytime soon. I think there are five states, Connecticut, Delaware, Maine, Oregon, and Vermont, that have enacted some kind of legislation, mostly banning bags, although Vermont went for a trifecta last summer and they banned straws, polystyrene containers, and plastic bags. New York became the third state to ban bags, and you'll see California has a fair number of cities that have banned bags, and then also bagged bans in 2014. They were the first state to do so. So that's where the activity is, and California is leading the way on lots of other issues relating to plastic going forward, including discussions that would be beyond banning things. The place where you'll see the opposite is there is also a handful of states, and I think it's 10 maybe, that are in the interior. I mean, stop and think about it. You know, where this has happened is Maine and New York and Maryland, Oregon, California, Hawaii. These are coastal states, and some of the interior states, in the way that diagrams are usually drawn, or these are red states, the legislatures have passed legislation banning bans. And I think that's happened in about 10 states,
like,
and
preemptive,
including Florida, though.
Oh. I can't even with that state. I just, whatever.
That's kind of the lay of the land there, and I think that's just something to watch. There will be that kind of legislation will be coming and going sort of continuously as we go forward.
Side question, why plastic? Do you have any idea why plastic bags? This legislation is focused mostly on that. Is that just kind of like the easiest
I
lift?
I think they're easiest, but you know, remember, one of the greatest challenges, if you want to get rid of a plastic product, you have to have a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a replacement for, you can use paper bags. The plastic bag industry will tell you that paper bags have a greater carbon footprint, mm-hmm, than their own bags.
Because they're heavier.
You can consider the source of that. As I said, even the reusable bags that you can get from virtually any grocery store and now many department stores have a plastic component in them, but they're called cloth bags, but they're not fully cloth, and they last longer. You can reuse them,
mm-hmm,
and so they've come up with a solution, a new kind of bag to carry your stuff home in, and you don't need to use another bag. Many other products, nobody's come up with an answer yet.
Right.
So those things still remain there.
What about bioplastics? What are bioplastics, first of all?
Biodegradable plastics. There are companies that are spreading all around the world that are purporting to create biodegradable products, bags, other products. And that's still pretty experimental.
Mm-hmm.
They'll all be upset with me for saying what I'm saying, but for instance, the EU does not want to deal with these until somebody writes standards for what a definition is of a biodegradable bag.
Mm-hmm.
And some places have done that, and others have not. I have not met a marine scientist who thinks biodegradable bags are the answer, because they shouldn't end up in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, the problem isn't necessarily the bag. It's the additives that are added to the plastic that give the bag its properties, one of which is strength to carry something home if it's a bag, or durability. And while the bag itself, the plastic components that make up the bag, may be biodegradable, those additives are a whole nother question. So Plymouth University did a study they published it last summer. They had buried some bags,
mm-hmm,
I think it was 2 years, and they...
Bioplastic bags?
A compostable bag, a biodegradable bag, a special kind of biodegradable bag, and then I think just a plain bag. And the biodegradable bags, when they dug them back up again, you could still carry groceries in them, and it caused a big sort of brouhaha
yeah.
With the the manufacturer and so on. So without belaboring the point, I think that it's something that more research is needed to refine this. The other issue on those is biodegradable things need heat, warmth. In ocean water, even in the tropics, is cool, and it's very difficult for things to biodegrade in the ocean. And compostable bags, which is a different animal from a biodegradable bag, most of them, when they say it's, they don't mean that you can throw it in your backyard lawn clippings pile. It needs to be composted in an industrial composter with very high temperatures. The final argument on both biodegradable and compostable is it encourages littering. It has people think, well, I can just toss this and it'll disappear in 2 months. It won't disappear in 2 months.
Are we meant to recycle biodegradable and compostable bags along with the other plastic materials, or do those require separate collection?
No, they need. Many recycling centers don't want them because the components of the plastic biodegradable bags are different from the regular plastics, and they would contaminate those other plastics if they got into that mixture, and so that presents another problem. I think what we're seeing on here, I mean, this is an industry that's in sort of, you know, still developing, and what you might have said about it 3 years ago is different than what you're saying, what you would say about it today, what I'm saying about it today, and in a few years down the road, there it's going to be even a different conversation. But it's really important for precautions to be taken, for clarity to be maintained as to what products that are purporting to be biodegradable are actually made of, and all of those things.
So, all right. So the upshot is, right now I'm just throwing my compostable and biodegradable bags in the trash. Like, that's pretty much the only thing I can do with them.
Yeah, unless there's an industrial composter near your.
Sure isn't. Not in
area where you can take them and they can be composted. In that
facility, yep. Not that I know of, in northern Brooklyn, but maybe I'm wrong. Okay, that's a super helpful breakdown. So in we have to wrap up in a couple minutes, but I could obviously talk to you forever. But if you start thinking about, like, systematic changes, is industry the one who really needs to lead on this, or do you think that we can see, like, the biggest impact through government regulation?
There is no single solution to this problem because it's global and it's massive. Industry certainly is going to play probably the dominant role because they're the only entity that's really large enough to scale any kind of solution. Government regulations will, or efforts to regulate in whatever form that takes, probably will serve as a prod to push the industry along. Because at the end of the day, what we haven't really talked about is what the continuing effect of all of this plastic building up in the ocean is having to marine life, and then ultimately the question of human health, which has not been determined. There has not been any finding that it causes any harm to human health. That doesn't mean that that's is going to remain a constant and it won't happen somewhere down the road. But right now, I have to be really clear that they have not. There is no evidence of harm to humans. There is evidence of harm to marine wildlife, both by strangulation, ingesting it and having it affect organs and puncture organs and cause damage. We read the stories, they're all one-offs about the whale that's eaten X number of pounds of bags. But larval fish are eating nanoplastics as some of their first meals of life when they've been studied off the coast of Hawaii, for instance, in their first few days of life. And we don't know right now what that means. What does that mean for the food chain? There are many, many, many questions out there about what the continuing accumulation of plastics in the ocean effects are having on the oceans itself and what lives in there.
So when you talked about earlier, the problem is, what are we doing about plastic waste? Would a substantial, part of this, would a big solution be if everybody recycled more properly? We would, that would make a big difference.
All of the above. The industry is working on redesign of certain products. Some products need to go away. Some products, packaging needs to be simplified. Instead of having three layers of different things that it's wrapped in, that packaging needs to be redesigned and reworked. When I say some products need to go away, maybe they're, and this is already a building market, instead of having something that's disposable, maybe it can be refillable. Consumers need to rethink how they use plastic products, how much waste they generate. All along the way, the answer to what do we do about plastic waste is all of the above. There is not one single answer.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Last thing, Nat Geo has a campaign to address the plastic crisis. Is that right?
Yes, we do. Thank you for asking. I meant to mention this. We have a three-year campaign or multi-year campaign that launched when we produced a plastic issue last summer, and or summer of 18. And our primary role here is to educate the public about what's going on with plastic and why we need to pay attention to it. And it is getting a lot of attention now. That doesn't mean that now that the world seems to be aware of it, that we can all sort of
go home,
brush our hands off and say, okay, well, we did our job. This is something that really needs to have a lot of attention until the solutions are really come up with. We just have conducted in the National Geographic Society team of 18 scientists have just completed an analysis of the Ganges River in India, studying on a pre-monsoonal trip and a post-monsoonal trip all of the things that I've talked about here in terms of how is the plastic getting from the river to the sea, what is the density of microplastics, where are the leakage points along the way, and what is the population density in those areas tell us about waste. And they're going to put, I think this is the first time that sort of hard numbers will be put on an analysis of a river system. And that work, it's pretty exciting and important, and that work will be coming out within the next year or so as the analysis done and the papers are written and are published in peer review journals.
And that
we
is
we also
oh yeah no
also,
no
we changed our the way in the building that we have plastic and have gone back to old-fashioned silverware, or if you want to be modern, bamboo disposable silverware that's biodegradable, and are serving beverages, in glass containers and glass or aluminum cans. We don't sell bottled water in plastic bottles in our cafeteria anymore. And so we're doing a variety of things in order to keep the focus on the fact that this is a very important environmental topic that has to be addressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Walking the walk. Well, this has been such a pleasure to have you on the show to discuss all this. For listeners who want to continue to follow your work, where would you direct them to find you?
We publish a lot of stories online at nationalgeographic.com and also in the magazine, but you'll find regular coverage on our website and in our social media accounts, Facebook and Instagram and so forth.
Yeah, and subscribe, right?
Subscribe to the website and subscribe to the magazine. Yes.
I know what my dad's getting for Christmas, by the way.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Of course. All right, Laura, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
Sure. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Okay. I want to, before we wrap up, I want to thank our sponsors, as always, for their generous support. I also want to thank Julia Devin and Jessica Duncan, who helped produce the show. Our show engineer is Jeet Paul, and show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes are available on the HRN website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening. Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.